Well, good morning, all. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning for this Tuesday, the 13th of January. Please excuse me if I have a little skip in my step, if I have a little joy in my heart, if I have a little sunshine pouring from my veins. It's because we have just a wonderful guest with us today who is a regular panelist. He's been with us for years and years as this panel has developed and transformed over the years. And he was always here in the Capital Region. Then he got a really cool job in another state. And we said, well, we still want you on the show. And he would do it by phone. And today, he actually came in and joined us in the studio. And it was a surprise to all of us. And we are just more than thrilled. Terry Gibson, preceptor in public speaking, strategic communication, train conductor.
What was that?
Yeah, that's my. I turned it on. And okay, I don't need to bore you with it, but my phone decided it was going to go into accessibility mode earlier today, and I was like pressing all these buttons trying to figure out how to get it out of accessibility mode, which I apparently also turned on the. My apologies. he is with the public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, former state senator, formerly taught at New Paltz and RPI. And is just the coolest dude ever, and we are thrilled that you are here with us this morning. Thank you very much for being here. It's really good to see you.
It was good to see you and all of you, and thanks for that introduction. I wasn't expecting that. I'm so glad I could bring some joy into your life today.
Well, yes, you definitely brought joy. I will say at this point, doing this show and talking about what we're talking, it doesn't take much. but this is a really good, a nice sturdy rise, and I'm quite excited by it. I'm a little angry with you because you don't age at all.
I work really hard at that, and I'm so glad it's paying off.
Yeah. And I hope nobody on our panel takes offense to this, but I see these people every day. And there are times where I notice the ravages of time.
Getting older.
Yeah. You know, you just every once in a while, you're like, oh, I didn't notice that before. And then you come in, and I haven't seen you in almost a year. You look great.
Oh, thanks. You look great, too. You all look great.
Yeah, thanks.
I have aged, I will tell you. It definitely is there. I definitely feel it. It's amazing how time has flown by. But I am happy to be here. I'm still a huge fan of this station and a big supporter, and it's definitely worth the drive. And I think we're in a time right now where we got to keep speaking up. And so sometimes you just want to do it in person.
Well, it means a lot to us. It means a lot to us that you continue to do it, even with your gig at Harvard. And we thank you very much and are delighted that you are here today. Dr. Karen Riedel also joins us. Now, she told me she wasn't going to be here today either, and she came up. So everybody, we got the whole crew right in here in the studio, and we're very excited. Mike Spain was very quick to point out that Karen usually wins the award for coming the furthest for the show, because you're what, Westchester?
Westchester.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's a good solid 2 hours to come up, and it's always worth it for the same reason, as Terry just pointed out. Right?
So Terry,
I'm only 45 minutes further.
There you go. So
just barely,
it's very
just
nice
barely.
To have everybody.
But I should point out, the reason why I decided to come up was for when I heard that Terry was coming. No, actually, I just found out when I came up. But I'm actually excited to finally meet you in person. We've been on the show several times together. But the reason why I'm coming up here came up here this morning was to come to one of our excellent, fascinating events that the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley organizes in the area. Tonight we're going to be talking about the national security strategy, which will give us insights in, right, exactly, which will give us insights in the current foreign policy in Venezuela and what's coming up in Iran. We'll have our own wonderful Malia Dimont participating. And Malia actually used to be the director of strategy in the office of the Secretary of Defense, so she is well equipped to talk about the national security strategy. And Michael Hauser, a former executive and U.S. officer of the U.S. Department of State, And the moderator will be Ambassador Donna Welton. So it is an event that is open to the public. I know it's an extraordinary event. I cannot wait for it. I came up all the way for that.
Where is it being held?
It's going to be in Woodstock, in the Woodstock Library, a new building.
Nice.
And it will start today at 6:30. Open to the public. Anyone who wants to come, please join us. It'll be an illuminating event.
Very, very nice. You know, I don't, you certainly have a handle on this, and I, for no reason, want to tell you what to do. But here's a question. I'm just going to throw in a question. Do we have a foreign policy?
Yeah.
That's my first, a strategy? Like, that's my first question.
I was going to say national security strategy sounds like an oxymoron lately.
You have a lot to talk about.
Where's the strategy? There's going to be a lot to talk about.
All right.
We have the right people to do that.
And the time again, I'm sorry.
6:30.
6:30 at the Woodstock Library.
Woodstock Library.
Fantastic. And put on by the World Affairs Council that Karen is the president of, also professor of government at Dutchess Community College, and we're thrilled to have Karen with us. The Empire Report's J.P. Miller is here. Good morning, J.P. How are you? This is like it's State of the State Day, so it's like a big holiday for you.
It's a big holiday, but it's a lot of work on the holiday.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a great day, and I'm happy to be here, Joe.
Very good. Well, it's wonderful to have you. We'll talk a little bit about the State of the State later on and get an idea of what is up the governor's sleeve as we move forward to calendar year 2026. How many State of the States did you attend as a state senator?
I went to two.
Yeah.
That was enough.
Was it exciting?
Exciting? I don't know that I would use that word to describe it.
No. And our dear friend and just the backbone of the whole operation, former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here with all these great people. I can just sit and listen today and say a few comments, but there's so much wisdom in the room, I better not open my mouth too much.
Well, first of all, talk show hosts love to hear that. But second of all, please feel free to enter the conversation whenever you wish. We welcome you, listeners, to whatever on whatever subject you would like to chime in on. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We do have one more housekeeping item before we go on, and that is that our lockbox is open. We talked to the CEO and our development officer yesterday about some of the cool changes that we're doing for the fund drive this year, but all part of it is that lockbox, and it was very successful last time. We want it to be equally, if not more so, successful this time. We thank you so much for all that you've already done. The lockbox is simply a mechanism that we put the money in now so we don't have to put it in later during the actual fund drive, which begins on February 2nd. So whatever you can do to help. I was at an event the other night. A bunch of people came up to me and just wanted to soothe my soul and say, I've already given. And I tried to tell them that, like, I don't have that information on my phone to, like, check them off the list.
Yes,
but,
you do.
But, yes, I do. But, yes. So we're very happy that you are with us. Continue to be with us. All you have to do is go to WAMC.org and help us out. WAMC.org. Things are going very well. We want to continue that process. And, you know, as always, you're with us on this ride. If things start to go south, you're going to be the first people to know about it. So please do whatever you can. And we love you. We thank you for everything that you do. We say this to each other in the hallways when you all aren't listening, but we talk about you and we tell everyone that we can that you are the best listening audience in all of radio. We mean it. You are. And we want you to know that. And we thank you so much for the continual support and love that you give us around the 12 months of the year. So thank you very much. Again, WAMC.org. The lockbox is open and the fund drive officially begins February 2nd. WAMC.org. all right. I think we have all of the stuff taken care of. Now let's go to what's going on in our world. There is quite a bit going on in our world. There was a story yesterday in the New York Times. This came over yesterday evening. And it was the Pentagon used a secret aircraft painted to look like a civilian plane in its first attack on a boat that the Trump administration said was smuggling drugs, killing 11 people last September, according to officials briefed on the matter. The aircraft also carried its munitions inside the fuselage rather than visibly under its wings, according to these officials. Now, the non-military appearance is significant, according to legal specialists, because the administration has argued its lethal boat attacks are lawful, not murders, because President Trump, quote, determined the U.S. is in an armed conflict with drug cartels. But the laws of armed conflict prohibit combatants from feigning civilian status to fool adversaries into dropping their guard, then attacking and killing them. That is a war crime called perfidy. Retired Major General Stephen Lepper, L-E-P-P-E-R, former Deputy Judge Advocate General for the United States Air Force, said that if the aircraft had been painted in a way that disguised its military nature and got close enough for the people on the boat to see it, tricking them into failing to realize they should take evasive action or surrender to survive, that was a war crime under armed conflict standards. Shielding your identity is an element of perfidy, he said. If the aircraft flying above is not identifiable as a combatant aircraft, it should not be engaged in combatant activity. So now we look at this and say what, from what I understand, the press office has declined to comment on the nature of the aircraft used in the attack, but the Pentagon insisted in a statement that its arsenal has undergone legal review for compliance with the laws of armed conflict. So that is where we are as of this moment on this 13th day of January. Terry, you came all this way. Please start us off.
Well, I'm certainly no military expert, but if you listen to the experts, it does seem that some type of illegal action has been taken here on behalf of the United States. More importantly, I want to know why we're just now finding out about this. And it
happened
does,
in September.
And it does just appear to be another example in a long line of recent examples of how the Trump regime is willing to break all norms, is willing to take any action they feel they want to take, regardless of how it applies to any type of laws or the Constitution. And I still think we, as Americans, are owed a lot of answers about all the other attacks that have happened there, including this one and the others. I feel like that has still been kind of left out there without really being justified in ways that I think the public deserves. So I'd like to have more information, and I'd still like to see members of Congress stand up and demand that more investigations happen and that more information be revealed.
Karen.
This is a clear violation of international law. Now, our leaders have been very open about their disdain for international law. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, looked it up again, what he called international law, a crazy maze of rules of engagement. And of course, the most recent New York Times interview, 2-hour interview with President Trump, showed again his disdain for international law, where he said numerous times that he is, in the end, the final arbiter of the limits of his authorities. So I was thinking yesterday as I was reading this article, which was really very good in the New York Times and explained very well why it is so important to make it very clear when a military plane is a military plane and under what circumstances hiding the military from a plane might be acceptable, for example, for defensive reasons when it comes to rescue of hostages. Under those circumstances, it would be acceptable, but certainly not in an offensive manner. So why is it so important for us to uphold international law? So there was a very recent NPR Ipsos survey that asked American citizens, should we be a moral leader in the world? And the absolute majority of Americans said yes, and then 39%, however, at this point, actually believe that we still are a moral leader. I don't know whether the 39% have actually been reading the news recently, but the majority of Americans feel that we should be a moral leader and we're not anymore. Internationally, certainly the United States has lost credibility as a leader, which limits our ability to shape policies in other states, which has made us so powerful in the last century. And we have given up on that. This is yet another step that we've taken to undermine our own credibility. If we don't uphold international law, we give others a carte blanche to do the same to us, to our troops. Ultimately, we put our troops and civilians at risk by not upholding international law. And finally, and this has to come to mind when we read an article like this, who is to say that an actual civilian plane won't be mistaken as a warplane and shot down? We should be terribly concerned about the impact this has on us.
Yes. You know, and when you're talking about morality, this comes also as part of this New York Times interview that was done last week. I think, a 4-hour interview, 2 hours of it is public. There is a transcript. You can watch it, so forth. But President Trump has stated in that interview that as commander in chief, he's constrained only by his own morality and own mind, not by international law or other checks on power. So even when you talk about those numbers of what, you know, what's the definition of is, what's the definition of morality and whose morality and who is guiding that in this discussion? Mike Spain.
Yeah, I think it's important. While recognizing this is a clear violation of international law, the Defense Department manual concerning the law of war explains that combatants must distinguish themselves from the civilian population and may not, quote, kill or wound an enemy by resort to perfidy. It explicitly prohibits feigning civilian status and then attacking. So it was interesting that this was the first of the 35 attacks of boats in the Caribbean by the Pentagon, and they didn't do it after that. So probably there was uproar within the department to say, how can we do that? We can't do that. So it shows that there is definitely some kind of tension going on within the Pentagon. And then the other, just to, I'll add this, when the Pentagon kicked all the real legitimate reporters out of the press pool because they wouldn't sign a loyalty oath that let the Pentagon preview and approve everything that they wrote, we were worried that reporters weren't going to be able to be the watchdog on the Pentagon. I'm pleased and very impressed that the New York Times has defied that and showed us that this reporting will go on, and there are people within the Pentagon who do have a moral compass and want to see these revelations so that it can be held accountable to the American public.
One of the things, too, is will more come out, but is of the many attacks that took place, was it just the one with this aircraft,
or
were there others? And that's another question that can be asked. Maybe we can get to the bottom of that tonight on your panel. JP.
I'm surprised. You know, in all the military conflicts, now I'm not a military expert, but I have not heard of this word perfidy before. I never heard it. I don't know that we were accused of it in Iraq or Afghanistan or anywhere else. And I think it's interesting that that this is coming up now, and it's a little bit unbelievable that the United States, with all of our checks and balances in our military, that they would try this maneuver of painting a plane to make it look like a civilian aircraft. It seems odd to me. I also wonder, with all of our great technology in terms of engaging the enemy and knowing, you know, you've seen the videos of people, you know, them being able to put a missile on literally on a dime 2,000 miles away or from 20,000 or 50,000 feet in the air, that we're resorting to painting planes to disguise it from the enemy. So it's an odd thing. It's an odd story to me, and it's just weird that this is what we're now resorting to. I don't quite understand that we're painting planes and what if. Also, if we're not attacking military targets, why are we worried about them firing back, right? One of their defenses was that the plane was broadcasting, squawking its military identity via radio signals. That was a defense of theirs. And military experts, according to the New York Times, said, well, the people on the boat probably lacked equipment to pick up that signal. So is there a responsibility on the U.S. military's part to, you know, broadcast that they're coming in and attacking?
And similarly to what I was saying a moment ago, the idea that this is the first way that you're going to do it. It's not as if you tried it another way that was not successful and then you did it this way. It was that this is what you started with at the beginning, which I find interesting. I'm with you, JP. I will say that as a book nerd, the only reason I know perfidy and the word and the meaning is because there were two novels. One was by Ben Hecht, and the other one was by James Ellroy, and about similar concepts. And that's the only reason I know it. And I didn't even really realize it as a military term, but it's fascinating. When you think about, and Karen, I'll start with you on this, but okay, everyone seems to be in this room. Everyone seems to be that the Times talked to of the experts that this violates, that this is a war crime. Okay, now what? What happens as a result of the United States allegedly committing a war crime in this particular manner?
Nothing. I mean, that's the problem with international law. International law is notoriously difficult to be enforced, and it relies heavily on the buy-in of the members of the international community, of which the United States until recently was the moral leader. And again, I can only emphasize the benefits that the United States has gained in economically, in terms of security, and we're proactively undermining these factors in our standing in the world. So there isn't a real way to enforce, especially not with a powerful country like the United States, international law and to see any consequences as a result of violating international law. But what is interesting to me, JP, and to build up on your argument and to partially respond to Joe's question is I feel that this administration is proactively going out to undermine international law. They are very open about it. It's not like the United States hasn't violated international law in the past, but and generally we try to hide it. At this point, where there is both the president and the Secretary of Defense are making a point of the need to violate international law for U.S. interests. And that, by the way, and I'm going to mention it again, the National Security Strategy actually makes that very clear as well.
You know, the reason that we have really lost our position as a leader of moral conduct in the military and just in general government operations is because we have essentially handed over the moral decisions to the most immoral individual that I can possibly think of, which is Donald Trump. And that's really what has happened. Congress no longer is exerting its authority when it comes to anything related to morality. The American people are split on this, and you know, that did put Donald Trump in office. They put a amoral person in office, and he has now taken his authority to a degree that many could never have imagined, and truly wants to be the decider of what is good and what is bad. And we're seeing that with Venezuela. I think we're about to see that in Iran, and we're certainly seeing it with the drug boats in Venezuela. And I think we're just at the early stages of these types of actions. And you know, the American people are going to be the only ones that can really stand up and stop this. And so we got to keep speaking up.
Who's listening?
this is a good question. Who's listening and who's listening that has the authority to stop it? I think that the people in Congress who are elected in their districts, there is a line of which when they feel enough pressure from the American public, certainly those people in their district, they will stand up and push back against Donald Trump. But we're just nowhere near putting that kind of pressure on them, especially in the Republican districts where the pressure really needs to be applied very hard. Until that happens, he will continue to operate as a sole individual who is held accountable by no one other than, as he's mentioned, his own morality, which we know is basically non-existent.
The other thing overall, and I'm interested in what you all think about this, but overall, these missions, I mean, we keep learning more and more that's been creeping out as to how they're being done, even initially with the additional strike later. I mean, there's a lot that comes out after the fact, and which is my long way of saying we don't have a really good sense of what's happening in any of these, do we? I mean, there really is a activity that is taking place that, even though there have been hearings and questions and a lot of this case being one of them, a lot of debate and spotlight put on what happened, we still don't really know. We don't have a great sense of what this operation is, what they're trying to do, and what has been the result of it.
Well, we may talk a little more about it later on if we have time, but I mean, there's apparently several military options on the table regarding the U.S. response to the way that the Iranian government is cracking down on free speech, the brutal way that they're cracking down. Over 500 people have been killed by the government, according to the most recent reports. And we're apparently considering all kinds of options, according to various news reports. But that is because of leaks, not because we've announced it.
Right.
Although it could be strategic leaks intended to get into the press to give a little oomph to the idea that we're being forceful and pressure Iran. I mean, it's all part of the game. But it's not unusual, Joe, when you think about it, to not know real time what's going on with the military, and it's only afterwards that there's transparency and accountability, if at all.
No, and I mean mostly the inconsistencies with international law, and also as even how many people were killed in any given operation, or the fact that there was an operation at any given time. But yes, you're right, of course. JP?
Yeah, Mike, going along with that, I have thought with what's happened in Venezuela and what we are now seeing in Iran, you know, a key part of the MAGA agenda was America first, and that the old Republican politics of George Bush and interventionism was failed policy, and that we're going to focus here on America and we're not going to get involved in stuff outside of the country. And very quickly here in the first year of the term, that what I would say is a key pillar of the MAGA agenda it now seems to be out the window with Iran, Venezuela, Greenland. And I wonder if you see some, not many, but some Republicans peeling away. And I wonder if you may see some others with regards to this and tying in with also along with the foreign policy, what's happening with Senator Warner. I wonder whether you will see some more Republicans peeling away and folks knowing that the House and Senate are likely to go Democratic next year. And Terry, what you're saying with the folks in Congress, you know, there are so few with the gerrymandering both by the Republicans and the Democrats. There are so few competitive districts. Both sides, the Democrats and Republicans, both fear primaries much more than they fear generals elections. And it's pushing both sides to the extremes, in my view.
Yeah. And I think also to the point about the MAGA agenda, I think what we're seeing, which many of us always suspected, was that the MAGA agenda was never really Donald Trump's agenda. Donald Trump's agenda was always Donald Trump first. He only got on board with America First because he found that a lot of people liked that idea and it could get him into the White House again. But I don't think it was ever really his direction, because what we're seeing right now is that he doesn't really care about what goes on in America. He's discovered that actually getting anything done in America that would benefit the people is just really hard to do, and he doesn't have the skills or the people in place to do it. It's much easier just to use the authority that was given to me and now really given to me by the Supreme Court to take my massive military and just go around and do what I do best, which is just beat people up and use the military force to do that and get my way and make myself feel good. It's really Donald Trump first. That's what we're looking at. And again, until Congress stands up and decides that they want to operate a government and take responsibility for what happens here and look out for the people that elected them, this is going to continue to happen. I do think even in these safe districts, you have people that are really hurting. You know, most people in this country right now are really hurting economically, for sure. They are not getting the type of health care services they need. They're not getting the type of jobs and employment they need. They're not getting the types of care they need in general. Just the cost of living is too high. There is going to come a point where even in a safe district, you're going to start hearing from your constituents. And I think that pressure is building and building and building. And at some point, they will wake up and begin to push back on Donald Trump.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters on this subject. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll get to as many letters as we can. And again, we welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this 13th day of January. A lot to discuss. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Michael writes to us and says, notwithstanding all the chaos that Krasnov is fomenting in order to take the focus off of the Epstein files, please ponder why Republicans in Congress are so silent. Normally, there are so many things they would strongly object to and use their authority to rein in the administration. Many wonder why they don't seem to be worried about losing in the midterms, because it seems obvious both the Senate and House will flip. Perhaps they all know there will be no elections in November. It is sickening that somewhat reasonable Republicans are more concerned with keeping their jobs than standing by and watching our country burn to the ground. No concerns for their constituents or even their family's future.
Well, to JP's point, we do have an enormous amount of safe districts in this country, and so many, most of the elected officials in Congress are not in seats that are really considered in play for an election. So without the public standing up and demanding these individuals do their jobs, regardless of whether they have a primary or whether they have a serious opponent, this will continue. You can see that that pressure just still isn't in a place that's moving them to this point. And they're still, many of them are still just terrified of Donald Trump and what he can do with his microphone. He can make their lives miserable in a second. And many of them are just not willing to go there because it puts them and their families in serious jeopardy. When they upset Donald, they're not willing to take that risk.
Building on the listener's comment, I'm going to say there will be elections in November, but this isn't really the question. We shouldn't focus so much on elections per se. Elections per se do not make a system democratic. We are clearly moving toward what is called competitive authoritarianism. There will be elections, and there are still opportunities for opposition parties to win seats, but there have been institutional measures taken really since 2019 that will make it harder and harder for opposition parties to really compete. And clearly, the voice and the weight of individuals' votes in the United States are becoming weaker and weaker. And that's where we're heading. We will continue having elections, but are they going to be free and fair? That is very questionable.
Let's also go to this letter on perfidy from Gabor. The prohibition of perfidy applies only in armed conflict, war in which killing of enemy combatants is permissible. The drug boat attacks are not war. They are a law enforcement operation where human rights law, not the law of armed conflict, applies. Under human rights law, no killing is permissible except in self-defense. All the drug boat killings are murder, pure and simple, regardless of whether military or civilian aircraft are used. That is one interpretation of it. Again, we heard the interpretations of other experts within the New York Times piece saying that it does indeed violate international law and can be considered a war crime.
You know, we still haven't seen any evidence that demonstrates that these drug boats are actually a real threat to the United States. And we haven't even seen real evidence that these drug boats are carrying drugs.
Right.
And yet we're continuing to, or at least we were until recently, continuing to bomb them and kill these people. So, you know, I think we just still have a lot of unanswered questions about the justification for doing this in the first place. And if anything we've done is illegal, that needs to be called out as well. So I'm afraid that this is all just going to get put on the back burner. We're going to focus on Iran now and whatever happens there, which could be any moment. And without Congress stepping up, there's really nothing that can be done.
I may be ignorant too, but I thought, you know, when we went after Venezuela just now, I found out that they have 17% of the world's oil. And so they have more oil than Saudi Arabia. They've got all the there's nothing you'd rather have, you know, in the ground than oil. And oil, in my view, is a pretty simple business. You pump the oil out and you sell it abroad and you make a lot of money. And why Maduro would have that nice business ready at his disposal to feed his entire population, keep everybody fat and happy, and instead engage in manufacturing illegal drugs, which to me seems like a very difficult business. It's illegal. There's a lot of, you know, it's, in my view, tougher to produce
right.
illegal drugs than pump oil out of the ground. And why he's pursuing that rather than the business of oil. Yeah. It makes no sense to me.
A lot makes no sense. And just going back to what you're saying, Terry, you know, we did 75 of those bombings since September. Isn't that right? 75?
I believe that's the number.
Yeah, right. And they haven't been any since Maduro was arrested or captured or, you know, the government was decapitated. Has all those illegal drug transports stopped, alleged transports? You know, it makes you wonder, was the strategy using the boat bombings to simply provoke the situation, put pressure on Maduro, and now that we have taken Maduro out, it's not a necessary tactic anymore. It just underscores that they may or may not have been drug boats. And it wasn't our intention to stop the interdiction of drugs. It was to provoke Venezuela solely, because what Coast Guard usually does is they go capture these boats. They get people to turn, and then they go after the sources of these drugs. You know, that it's all so murky.
Jay writes, I agree with JP 100%. Trump only cares about money and himself, period. The question is how do we wake people up to that and end his stranglehold? That from Jay. Teresa says, please explain to me. This was a statement, and I listen extremely carefully to all of you during the show. But as of this moment, I don't know which one of you said about both sides, taking both sides to the extremes. Teresa picked up on that little bon mot and says, please explain to me, what is the extreme the Democrats are being pushed to?
Well, I was saying that when there are safe seats, there are that makes incumbent politicians more worried about a primary than a general.
Yes.
Right? And so they're not worried about appealing to the middle of the country, the middle moderate voters. They're more worried about appealing to the extreme or the more extreme voters on the right and the left who tend to show up for primaries.
As a result of that, like in a Democrat district, you might have a perhaps more liberal Democrat running for re-election who's worried about being able to be re-elected and moving more to the center instead of moving more to a traditional liberal perspective. And that ends up not being, it softens their positions on whether it's gun control, whether it's abortion or reproductive rights, whatever traditional Democrat positions are, they're moving towards the center. And then you have the Republicans moving to the right, and you end up with sort of a tilted government that is not broad-based, and the traditional Democratic liberal positions are way in the minority because of it. It seems like that.
Well, I would say that both sides are going to the extreme.
Let's go to this letter from John. Yes, Congress needs to stand up against Donald Trump, but they need to do it in bunches. Standing up one or two at a time is not effective, and they quickly get attacked by Trump. Well, you would think it would be easier, like safety in numbers, right?
It would certainly be better if more of them stood up. But the letter writer is exactly right. And if it's just still one or two on the Republican side, for sure, it's just not quite enough. Unless those people are in a position of authority where they can actually stop, say, you know, a Senate approval of something. But there aren't that many of them that can do that. So, you know, again, it just each one of these individual elected officials is in a very different district. It's held accountable by a very different group of voters. And so you can't really lump them all in and say they're all alike, because they all kind of report to and answer to different types of people. But the things that we're talking about here are just basic sort of human moral aspects that really shouldn't matter what party you're in. Do you want to live in a country that is looked up to by the rest of the world as a place that upholds laws and upholds morals and values and is safe and secure and welcoming? Or do you want to be part of a country that is discriminatory in every possible way and dangerous and threatening and a bully and has no respect from any of your allies anymore? I mean, which country do you want to live in? It's that simple. And I think most people in this country would prefer to be in a place where we can be respected by the world, and we're really losing that respect very quickly.
But it comes down to Trump's moral code, and that has – I mean, I think we have – glimpses of it, but
because he's the only one exerting authority right now. He's telling the Justice Department what to do. He's telling ICE what to do. He's telling Congress what to do. He's telling every branch of our government what to do, because no one is pushing back to a degree that's stopping him. We're seeing glimpses of it every now and then, but not enough. And that's how dictators begin.
Let's see. JD writes, it's a mystery as to why the administration is willing to respond with potential airstrikes on Iran over killing protesters when protesters in our own country are seen as his enemy.
Yeah, these contradictions, both in Venezuela and in Iran, and even in the United States, are just mind-boggling. There's so many of them.
Yeah, and to that point, we're defending the ICE officer in Minneapolis. And they immediately came to his defense and said that he was the victim of domestic terrorism by this poor woman who was killed. And then MAGA people attacked police officers on January 6th, and they've been given pardons. And there's just, you know, videos showing that, and we let them off the hook, because when my guys attack cops, it's okay. But when somebody else, my enemies, attack cops or even drive away from cops, it's the cops that it's the person's fault if they get killed, not the cops.
And remember in D.C. back during the George Floyd riots, and there was a big riot, a big protest in D.C. And that's when Donald Trump came out with his military leaders. And remember, he went over to the church and held up the Bible.
Yes.
And that was a time where we had actual reporting that identified that he had asked the military if they could just shoot the protesters in the legs to stop them. He had asked that here in his own country. So it's so contradictory, because you know that Donald Trump does not want any protest. He's quickly trying to take over the media. He's trying to take over how information is shared in this country, just like is happening in Iran and is continuing to happen in Venezuela. He's going to do whatever he can in this country to push back against protesters, so that he's now somehow the decider about who can protest and who can't, and who to protect and who not protect in other countries. It's just bizarre and beyond explanation.
Let's see. Patty writes, the proper term for Trump's behavior is immoral. Immoral, so A-moral, A-M-O-R-A-L. As opposed to immoral, I-M-M-O-R-A-L. Suddenly, I
feel like it can't be both.
Suddenly, I think I'm in Young Frankenstein. Yeah. Igor, yes. Abby someone? Yes, Abby Normal. Immoral implies appreciation for right and wrong. His, quote, my morality approach does not include that. An excellent point brought up by Patty. We will pause there, and we will continue our conversation. Step back for a few moments, let the dust settle, have a break, have a little news with Ray Graff, and we'll return with this fantastic panel after these messages. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning. It is the 13th of January, 6 minutes past 10 o'clock, and we thank you so much for being with us as always. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. You know the drill. We can't read all the letters, but we certainly try to get to as many as possible and kind of get the mood of the room as we read through the letters, keep them short and to the point, and that ensures that we can get to as many as possible. Let's go to a new subject and something else that another topic to talk about. Mark Kelly is suing Pete Hegseth over censure and a potential demotion. This is the latest twist in an unusual feud stemming from a video in which several Democrats reminded U.S. troops that they can refuse illegal orders. Senator Kelly filed the lawsuit Monday seeking to reverse Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's letter of censure and effort to potentially demote the retired Navy officer, sharply escalating a confrontation between the Arizona Democrat and the president. Pentagon chief over a video reminding U.S. service members that they can refuse these illegal orders. This from the Washington Post. In the lawsuit filed in D.C. federal court, Kelly's lawyers argue that the Pentagon's inquiry and formal reprimand unlawfully punished the senator for his speech, violated his due process. It appears that never in our nation's history has the executive branch imposed military sanctions on a member of Congress for engaging in disfavored political speech, the lawsuit says. The Pentagon said it was aware of the lawsuit, but otherwise declined to comment. Next steps in the case, which was assigned to Judge Richard Leon, an appointee of President George W. Bush, could come quickly. The Pentagon directed Kelly to respond by January 20th to a query from the Board of Military Officers, whom Hegseth tasked with determining whether the senator will be demoted in retirement. Kelly's attorneys have asked the court for a preliminary injunction that would pause that process while the lawsuit goes forward.
Do I understand correctly that Hegseth has actually single-handedly appointed this military panel? Is that what you just said?
From the Board of Military Officers, I don't know if he appointed them, but he has tasked them.
Okay. Because if he has any sway over who is on this panel, that would be reason for real concern, of course. You have to believe that in the Pentagon there still is a large number of employees and military officials that believe in the rule of law and that believe that Mark Kelly is certainly a legitimate American hero, if there ever was one living right now. The idea of going after him is just absurd and really reflects badly on the military that you would attack one of your own in this particular way. So I have to hope that there's still enough sanity in the Pentagon to push back on this. But you wonder, with the president, I'm sure, being behind this, if there's still danger that Kelly could be demoted.
I was reading about this and reading more military law than any human should. But it is fascinating because if to be demoted and to lose your rank, it's extremely rare to do it when you've already retired. So, in other words, you have to be an active member to have that, unless you can, unless it is so egregious in regards to your position that you held in within the military, then you could have this demotion. How they prove that, I don't know, meaning how Hegseth and the administration would prove that in a court, I don't know.
What gets me about all this is Hegseth, who was a weekend host on Fox News, and then he had been in the Army Reserve and the National Guard. His military background compared to Senator Kelly is just, I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean,
Mikey has cooler military tattoos.
Yeah, right. But he doesn't have a beard, but neither does Kelly. But, I mean, when you think about Kelly was an Edson in the Navy at age 22. You know, he went to Iraq. He flew bomber missions. He was almost, you know, a bomb went off next to him. He came back and went to NASA, went on the space shuttle. He likes to point out that he was part of the recovery mission that recovered the astronauts who died on the Columbia. And then plus, you know, he was in, while his wife, Gabby Giffords, was recovering from the gunshot wounds to her, he was still partly in active duty then. And I mean, he's a dedicated, completely, total heroic American, and this puny little guy who was on Fox News is going after him. It's unbelievable to me.
Now, isn't it? I want to hear everybody on the subject, but and apologize for me being sarcastic or cynical, or both, but. Do you think this deal would be as big if Mark Kelly didn't seem to now be the front runner for the Democrats in the 2028 election?
And let's remind ourselves that there are five other people who are involved in this message, which, by the way, and again, I think it's important to remind ourselves, I'm sure most of our listeners know this, of course, that Mark Kelly did nothing wrong. It's like,
right.
All he said was, remind troops, by the way, you have the right and an obligation, right, to stand up against illegal actions. We just spent the entire morning talking about illegal actions committed by our military. But it's, and I find this discussion, by the way, fascinating to put troops in a situation of having to decide whether an action is illegal or not. And then even if it is illegal and they stand up against it, they still face consequences. But that's a different matter. But so Mark Kelly is one of six who were part of it. Why is he the only one targeted?
That was your question, right, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the answer, right?
That's the answer, right?
Well, he's the most well-known. He has the most following. He has the biggest name recognition.
Arguably the most power.
Well, is he also the only former military person?
No.
They're all military people.
Are they all U.S.
CIA,
senators, though?
CIA
no.
analysts?
Well, yeah, he's targeted
but they were
because
all
he's a U.S. senator, yes.
They were all members of Congress.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, but they could demote any of them and take away their pensions. But it seems to be he's the one that obviously is being targeted as a result.
If Mark Kelly is actually considering running for president, this would be great PR for him. I mean, if they're trying to somehow make him not a desirable candidate, this is going to work in the opposite direction because it gives him a platform to really promote himself.
I'm just going to get momentarily cynical or sarcastic. Cynical, I think, in this case. I got, and I counted them on Sunday, but I got 22 emails from Mark Kelly on Sunday.
He's busy.
Seems like he's running, right? I mean, it seems
like. Well, this is great for fundraising for him too.
I mean, well, exactly, and that's what they are. They're not under his name, but they're from the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I would be very surprised if he was going out in such a way. And the language of the pitch is such that this is what they're doing to me. They're trying to shut all of us down. if we are going to move ahead and if we are going to get out of from under the thumb, this is what we must do together.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's if the point of it is to somehow make him not be a viable candidate, they're just doing the actual opposite of that.
Right. Yeah.
To be able to be the one who says, I stood up to Donald Trump and pushed back. And on behalf of all of you, I'm willing to stand up there and fight, and I'm not scared. And I mean, he's a leader. He's always been a leader, and that's why he's an American hero.
But you also see what the Republicans did to John Kerry.
Well, yeah, and I think that's a really good point. You know, they swift boated him, and that's the term. They took a three-time honoree, a Purple Heart honoree, for his military service and turned him into a coward in the eyes of the American people. And George Bush, who was a draft dodger, who didn't even show up for his National Guard service, somehow looked like a war hero. I mean, you know, that
turned his strength into a weakness. That was Karl Rove, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it. I do worry that there's enough MAGA people who will listen to these accusations that Kelly is guilty of sedition, which Hegseth said, and go along with it. There are people that are not enough, maybe, but there are people that still blindly follow the MAGA mouthpiece that comes out of Washington, and it's scary. I mean, I just thought by now more people would have said, yeah, that's not for me anymore, and I don't see it.
I find this issue interesting. This has been brewing for a while now, and I think we may have talked about it one other time, but this is really the first time we've talked about it in some detail. But and I'm fascinated by what you were saying, Karen. There are other people involved, and yet this is what they're going after. And but obviously. And correct me if I'm wrong here or if you disagree, but I was delighted to, 'cause usually when people talk about lawsuits, they don't come this fast and they don't come this furious and they don't and the fact that this seems to be, as I read in the article from the Washington Post, that it seems like a decision is going to be made fairly quickly.
January 20th, this panel is supposed to issue a recommendation, so the court could intervene to block that, which is what Kelly is seeking.
Right. So I just give Kelly a bit of credit for also making this an issue and something that is to be discussed immediately, as opposed to letting it fester, as often is the case, in some hope that things will, I don't know, get better.
You know, it's interesting timing, too, is that over the weekend, of course, and you've talked about this a lot yesterday, we don't need to repeat it, but Jerome Powell,
yes,
the Fed chair.
Very similar.
Ordinarily, people like Jerome Powell say very, calm things, and they say, we'll just take the course, and they try to ignore the pressure that's on them and just try to look, you know, strong. And that has turned out to be a weakness that a lot of people who follow that convention have. So Sunday, he took the gloves off and said, this isn't about some building renovation and comments I may have made to Congress about it. This is all about Trump trying to bully the Fed and trying to make the Federal Reserve Bank not independent, which has gotten us through this country for over almost 250 years since Alexander Hamilton formed it. I mean, I think maybe it's a sign that the people who are being put down by Trump, and Jerome Powell is not a Democrat. He was a Republican, and he was a Trump appointee. But people who are being put down by Trump are beginning to see that you have to stand up. You can't quietly go and let him pound on you. And that's maybe what Kelly is, what's inspiring about Kelly right now.
Well, yeah, and Kelly's seeing that it's actually helping him. And it's same thing with Powell, same thing with Letitia James, same thing with James Comey, which is Trump is trying to intimidate and affect policy towards him. And in fact, the people that he has targeted have become emboldened since he targeted them. They've become stronger. And so what he's doing, what I think Trump's doing is making himself weaker and having the opposite of the intended effect with these four concrete examples.
It's interesting. I find this fascinating that during the in the days up to leading up and even after the, January 6th, 5 years ago, that President Trump was saying, well, it's this, and this are the problems. And then they would go to court and they would say, well, no, that's not true. None of that happened. And, oh, it's the these machines, those machines, that machine. Well, no, that doesn't seem to be the problem. And that we're seeing that same, and even in talking to the New York Times, said one of his regrets was not taking those machines and seizing
them.
And impounding them. What I find interesting and how it relates to this is look at the, even with Comey now, with this case just imploding from the very first moments yesterday, they say, okay, well, we're going to take your first deputy of the person who was in charge, the woman who was in charge, and you're going to take this case. And he said, no, I'm not going to take that case because that case can't go anywhere. I'm not doing that. And then they said, okay, well, you're fired. Well, now what do they do? You know, and I find that. So it is like a dog with a bone. He's not going to give up on it anytime soon.
Well, it tells you where the president of the United States puts all of his time and energy. I don't know that we have ever had a president, certainly not in recent history, that has really made a priority every single day, every waking moment, to sit around and think about how can I go after my individual enemies? How can I make their life miserable? He's not thinking about how he can improve the lives of American citizens. He's not thinking about how he can really protect America, make us stronger. He's just thinking about how he can go out and make the lives miserable of those who have spoken out against him or done things he doesn't like. That's what he does all day long, every day.
I mean, there's a term that we can't use on the radio, but I mean, the guy's got, just to be able to say, we're going to go after Jerome Powell because of a project.
Yeah, I know.
an improvement project where every I wasn't dotted and every T allegedly was not crossed, and there were cost overruns as two-thirds of the White House is currently standing.
Yes.
It's quite amazing to me.
It is amazing. It is amazing that this president literally tore down a significant portion of one of the most historic buildings we have in our country that he does not own, that he is not in charge of, without any permits, without any approval, without any type of actual legal authority, asks no questions, and now somehow gets to decide how renovations at other government buildings are done, legally or not legally.
I will, as homework for listeners, but there was we're not going to talk about it specifically, but there was a really good article in the Times about the pressure campaign that was put on the president to go ahead with the case against Powell, and it's a fascinating look at what went into that. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Eric says, after Signalgate, it seems like it's Hegseth, not Kelly, whose rank and pension should be cut in retirement.
We do have a recording of Hegseth saying almost exactly what Kelly and the others said. There's a recording of him saying that that's been played many times on various media outlets prior to him becoming an official in the Trump administration.
Roger says, if they are successful in demoting Senator Kelly, every retired veteran would fall under that category if they said anything that Trump disliked. They could be demoted as well. Lord, help us all. That from Roger. All right. We have about 5 minutes before we go to a break. So let us go to a new topic that we have for you. And that is try to find something that we can maybe establish, and then we'll come back and talk more about it when we return. This is me vamping for time for letting my computer Well, see that JP. See, oh, okay, there it is. Okay,
looks good to me, Joe.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your help. Best pit crew in the business. Best pit crew. Okay, so. was it you, Karen, talking about midterm elections? I mean, you were, this is something that I wanted to touch base on because you were talking about we will have midterm elections.
We will.
We will. But what are they going to look like? And this article in the Washington Post under the label of Democracy in America with a headline that says Trump is trying to change how the midterm elections are conducted. Many of these endeavors go far beyond typical political persuasion, challenging long-established democratic norms. I think all of us could agree that none of this is new. These are tactics that have been used in one form or another since the president began his political career seriously in 2018. 5 years ago, President Donald Trump pressured Republican county election officials, state lawmakers, and members of Congress to find him votes after he lost his reelection bid. Now he's seeking to change the rules before ballots are cast. Trump, openly fearful that a Congress controlled by Democrats could investigate him, impeach him, and stymie his agendas, using every tool he can find to try to influence the 2026 midterm elections. And if his party loses, so doubt in their validity. Many of these endeavors go far beyond typical political persuasion, challenging, as I said, long established democratic norms. They include unprecedented demands that Republican state lawmakers redraw congressional districts before the constitutionally required 10-year schedule, the prosecution of political opponents, a push to toughen voter registration rules, and attempts to end the use of voting machines and mail ballots. Some of this is already successful, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Certainly the restrictions on voting, it is in many states, it is harder to vote now than it ever has been. And those are mostly, I think, exclusively really Republican states where a lot of new voter ID laws have been put into place, Texas, for example. The voting machines issue, I find difficult to accept that that could happen because one of the protections we do have is that each of these states controls its own elections. They've invested a lot of taxpayer dollars in setting up a voting system that includes these machines. It also includes a lot of employees that know how to operate these machines. If you replace them, what do you replace them with? What else do you go back to the 1950s where we have those old sort of pull lever machines that
right.
put a little mark on a piece of tape somewhere? I don't know how that would be. Of course, Donald Trump's point always is never logical. It's just to create chaos and confusion and to mix things up and to make things difficult to operate. So he doesn't really care what the final outcome is as long as it is one that requires that people sort of jump around and react and take actions that would ultimately create enough chaos that it could benefit him.
And just in our 45 seconds before we have to go to a break, I feel compelled to just state the obvious, which was inexplicably in the 2024 race in which Donald Trump was reelected president of the United States, all of these abnormalities, even though there was a Democratic president who was at the helm, did not seem to rear their head. So it must indeed be changed, even though it did not affect, it affected the election before it, but did not affect the election after it.
And that was true in 2020 when Trump did lose. Every other election, there was no questions about them. You know?
Correct.
You know, just that one
it
election.
It was just that one election.
Yeah, yeah.
And to quote Rudy Giuliani, this is very targeted. Okay. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up this conversation. We'll also finish up our general conversation with our panel. We'll have them for another half hour or so. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we'd love to hear from you. So last call on the letters as we go into our final half hour together. We will continue our conversation after this short break. good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Terry Gibson is with us in studio. We have been blessed, and we are so happy to have him with us. J.P. Miller joins us, the Empire from the Empire Report. Dr. Karen Riedel is here, and Mike Spain joins us as well. Today is the state of the state. Oh, my goodness. J.P. Miller, what do we know?
So it is the state of the state at 1 p.m., Joe. Governor Hochul.
Which you will be able to hear whenever it begins right here on WAMC.
On WAMC, absolutely. It's an election year for Governor Hochul. And so it's an important speech for her today. She's going to focus on affordability. The newly elected mayor and newly inaugurated mayor of New York City, Zohran Mamdani, will be there in Albany, his first trip to Albany since he was elected mayor of New York City. The biggest thing, in my view, that she will be announcing is a proposal to provide universal child care for every kid in the state in a phased-in manner over the coming few years. That's something that Mamdani campaigned on and that Governor Hochul is aiming to deliver this legislative session. And what I think you will see her take from Mamdani is affordability, affordability, affordability as she heads into re-election, focused a lot on utility prices and energy prices, focused a lot on housing policies in terms of building new housing to make housing, energy, and childcare more affordable. It should be a great speech. We should all tune in.
Do we have, and obviously the priorities will be outlined, and as you said, this is an election year, but do we assume, what do you think the GOP response will be, and will it help them set their agenda for the coming election, but in the coming weeks, obviously, as she tries to move her agenda through?
You know, Zogby came out with a poll today showing Blakeman, who's the Bruce Blakeman, who's the county executive in Nassau County, is the presumptive Republican nominee. He's right now, according to the Zogby poll, 15 points behind. Right now, it's dangerous to say this on January 12th, but she looks like she has a great chance of going cruising to re-election, not just because the Republicans have what many perceive to be a weak candidate in Bruce Blakeman, but the big thing is that this is going to be a midterm election during Donald Trump's presidency. And the incumbent president, if you look past through history, the last 50, 100 years, the incumbent president tends to have a very tough political environment. Governor Hochul is on the opposite side of Donald Trump, and so she should be in good shape. But Terry Gibson's a former state senator. I bet he has some thoughts on it.
Well, I think she has to just make sure she can avoid a primary. We talked about primaries before. That would be something that she would definitely want to avoid. So I'm sure putting this affordability up front right now is strategically important in trying to avoid that primary, because if she gets a primary, it'll be from obviously the extreme left. And so she has to really address all of the things that the new mayor of New York City really got elected on. She has to kind of make those part of her platform to keep the left happy and satisfied. If they become unhappy and unsatisfied, then you might be looking at a primary, which could really be damaging, although I'm not sure there is a viable primary candidate that could really raise the kind of funds they need to really run. But of course, New York State is always this strange place when it comes to elections statewide, because you have all the people in New York City, all the voters in New York City, that can easily turn an election one way or the other, regardless of what happens outside of New York City. And she, Governor Hochul, is obviously from upstate. She's not a New York City person. She's all connected.
Western New York.
Western upstate New York. And her connections to the city have always been a little, you know, difficult. And she comes from a much more conservative, much more moderate area, and is typically governed that way. And so this will be challenging for her, whether she has a primary opponent or not. She still has to stay on message and make sure that the people of New York see that she's dealing with the issues that matter to them most, which is certainly affordability.
Well, for affordability, can I ask, do you think there's much chance, either of you, of her embracing a major plank of Mamdani, and that is to make the rich pay more you know, some way to tax the rich, the wealthy in New York City, and have them contribute more to the operations, to the programs that he's trying to bring in to help people with affordability. Is there any chance?
So far she has said no new taxes on millionaires and billionaires, and I think that she looks to, right now, California has introduced a billionaire's tax in California, and there are dozens of billionaires leaving the state. And Gavin Newsom, potential 2028 presidential nominee, is opposing the billionaire's tax because he's saying, look, the state's, New York State's state budget, I think, is in the $240 billion a year
at least
neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You add on top of that billions of dollars in government spending in each county and each municipality every year. So there is government spending of about $300 billion a year in New York State. And Governor Hochul has said in previous interviews she does not want to alienate the folks that are paying the bills for what the government is providing.
With that said, there was a rare sighting in the city of Albany yesterday, and that is of the Lieutenant Governor, Antonio Delgado, who was in Albany yesterday speaking to reporters, saying that he plans to preside over the state Senate more often. He's actually, of course, he is the
president of the Senate.
Yeah. So constitutionally, that is his only role, serving as president of the state Senate and casting a tie-breaking vote if a four vote ends evenly split on a bill. That's a rare occurrence, given the Democrats currently control nearly a supermajority of Senate seats. In recent history, lieutenant governors have typically only presided over the state Senate on the first day of the legislative session or during other special occasions. But after doing so last week on the first day, Delgado was back again Monday to fulfill the role, saying, certainly going to keep moving around the state as well, like I've done in the past, but I'm going to try to preside a bit more, he said, this according to City and State New York. For Delgado, that means more time spent around legislators who may be willing to ditch Hochul in favor of him, and all on the state's dime. Two lawmakers have already jumped ship to Delgado. Besides, he doesn't have much else to do. The governor drastically cut Delgado's staff and budget, leaving him with only the barest bones of his office left at his disposal.
If his plan to somehow become a viable primary candidate against Governor Hochul is to spend more time in the state Senate, that's not going to work, because there's nothing less interesting and more boring and less appealing even to the media than that particular position. And the idea that he would ever have a chance to play a pivotal role in a contentious vote is almost historically not going to happen. Nothing comes to the state Senate floor without already knowing how it's going to end up. There are no mysteries. So the way you
still seem a little bitter after all these years.
Well, typically the way you build a statewide campaign is that you spend your time out in the districts where you think you need to gain votes, meeting people,
raising money,
not standing over a wooden lectern doing an official job, which anybody can really do, which has already kind of been preordained as to how it's all going to work out. It's just not a practical use of your time in terms of running for office. So I'm not quite sure who's giving him this advice, but I think it's flawed.
I would also say that two of our last three governors were former lieutenant governors. And how did those lieutenant, like Delgado, and how did those lieutenant governors get into office? Was they stayed dutifully by their governor and waited till that governor slipped on a banana peel like Elliot Spitzer did, and slipped on a banana peel like Andrew Cuomo did, and that's how David Paterson and Kathy Hochul became governor. And Delgado, in my view, had and has a great position as lieutenant governor. Kathy Hochul is certainly capable of stepping on a banana peel and putting in her lieutenant governor, but she is likely in the coming weeks going to be naming her new lieutenant governor candidate for 2026. Yeah. Delgado will be, you know.
Yeah. And let us just.
Antonio who? Yeah, that's what's going to happen.
Well, right. And remember Brian Benjamin?
Right.
Yeah. Brian Benjamin was Kathy Hochul's first lieutenant governor. and named and indicted after a year, which even by Albany standards is pretty quick.
Pretty good. Yeah. I was sitting right here. I remember when someone Sarah came through. News. That was great.
And you do have to wonder. And then obviously that chemistry didn't work between the two because it wasn't that long really that Delgado said, "All right, I'm going to continue my position, but I'm also going to run against you."
I think it's tough as a lieutenant governor if you're not okay just doing the ribbon cuttings and traveling around the state because you're not a member of the governor's senior staff. Is that correct, Terry?
Yeah, well, it's obviously up to the governor, but historically the governor has not really included the lieutenant governor in on these things. But there have been some exceptions, I think. I can't remember his name, but one of the first lieutenant governors that Andrew Cuomo had, I forgot his name.
Bob Duffy.
He was a pretty good guy, and I think he was involved in quite a bit. He ran this whole committee that was going on at the time that I remember participating in about trying to increase business and jobs across the state. He's very visible. To me, it seems like it's a great platform to build up name recognition, to get to know the state, to get to know the players in the state, to get to understand how the different districts operate. And, you get paid while you're doing it.
And the governor gets invited to tons of stuff all over the state, right? And you basically get your pick. All right, the governor can't go to this. Do you want to go and stand in for the governor? And
you pick me. I want to go to this funeral.
You can. Well, but Kathy Hochul
did that. She was everywhere.
She worked her butt off.
Cheerleader.
Yeah.
To the point of sometimes it was disturbing how much she was supporting Andrew. I mean, it really at times really grated on me and many others who thought that she had kind of gone too far in supporting him. So it was surprising she was able to actually pull this out and become governor because of that.
Yeah.
The other thing too, and we have to take a break. But in the rock paper scissors of politics, is it a natural move to say, okay, I'm going to give up a congressional seat to be the lieutenant governor of New York, where there is at that moment a mostly popular Democratic governor?
Yeah, I don't really know what the decision was in that. It could have been, family decisions. There could have been all kinds of reasons he didn't want to do that. He was just bored.
Being a member of Congress isn't that great either, I would argue.
It's not that exciting. And, you're away from your family most of the year and a lot of travel involved. And, of course, right now being an elected official is a legitimately dangerous job, especially if you're outspoken. So maybe all of that played a factor. I don't know, but it feels like the decision to really abandon Hochul and begin to sort of build your own platform and say, I'm essentially going to run against you, it seems self-destructive to me.
Mm. We'll take a break. We'll finish up when we come back. And we welcome your letters. Last call for those. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have about, 10 minutes or so with our group. And just one more topic, sort of two facets of the issue that we spent most of last week talking about, and that is the ICE shooting in Minneapolis and the probe that has gone on with that. The Justice Department division that regularly handles investigations of police shootings has not been brought into the probe of an immigration officer's fatal shooting of a woman in Minneapolis, according to multiple people familiar with the matter. The decision so far to not involve the Civil Rights Division's criminal section provides a window into the unusual way the Trump administration has handled this investigation. The move has deepened doubts already raised by Minnesota officials about whether the shooting will receive a fair and scrupulous examination. When you put that together with the state authorities being excluded from even access to the evidence, like shell casings, the car, I don't have any confidence that a use of force investigation is actually even happening when it comes to the death of Renee Good. That from Keith Ellison, the Democratic Attorney General of the state of Minnesota. Meanwhile, we look at the inquiry being done by the FBI. Federal investigators assigned to the fatal shooting of The 37-year-old Minneapolis woman, are looking into her possible connections to activist groups protesting the Trump administration's aggressive immigration enforcement, in addition to the actions of the federal agent who killed her. That, according to people familiar with the situation, it seems increasingly unlikely that the agent who fired three times at the unarmed woman will face criminal charges, although that could change as investigators collect new evidence, the people added. On Sunday, President Trump described Ms. Good and her wife as being professional agitators, adding that the authorities would find out who's paying for it. He offered no evidence to support his claims. Second part of that story from the New York Times, first part from the Washington Post. Mike.
Yeah, I think that the it's common to defend police officers after, or any public safety officers, after there's been a shooting of a civilian, an unarmed civilian. It happens, unfortunately, much too often. But then they're followed up by, but we have to let the investigation proceed. Let's just cool down and let the investigation proceed. That didn't happen here, of course. Kristi Noem was out there calling this poor woman a domestic terrorist within hours. You know, Trump was doing the same. J.D. Vance went on to do it. So they've enlisted all the talking points of this being a terrorist, and it just isn't holding up. And I think a big part of the problem is that police officers, this poor guy, I mean, I have some empathy for him. He probably didn't know what he was doing. He probably wasn't properly trained. He didn't go through a police academy like a typical police officer would have. He wouldn't understand the rules behind the use of deadly force. I think, you know, they took these $50,000 bonuses to take the job, recruited very quickly and thrown out on the streets. I think they are trained to be bullies. There's been plenty of evidence that they bully people. Elected officials have gone to ICE areas and where ICE is patrolling and been pushed to the ground and going to courts where ICE will knock them out. And I mean, it's disgusting what they're doing. They're almost like a Gestapo working as a separate, military, paramilitary unit. And it's really got this is why that happened, because this is not a normal police action. This is a terrible tragedy that should never have happened and could have been avoided.
And just imagine how many more of these tragedies we're going to see if it gets away with it, right? It's like it'll just be emboldening. And as I said, Mike, I fully agree. One of the issues here, of course, is that the lack of training and the lack of oversight of how they're being trained, how they're being prepared for the role that they took on by the thousands.
Well, the credibility of the FBI, the Justice Department, at this point in time, all government agencies is waning. It is becoming difficult for the American people to really have faith in these institutions that we've always had faith in. And I think the strength of our particular type of democracy has always relied on us all at the end of the day still having faith in these agencies to really protect us and do the right thing. And because of who has been appointed by Donald Trump to run all these agencies, and because they're all answering to him specifically, the credibility of all of them is now really questionable. And how can you run a country when the people of the country can no longer trust the government agencies?
I do think that we will likely see, may not see federal charges for the officer, but I do think that in Minneapolis we will likely see state charges. There are, of course, criminal charges against murder and manslaughter in Minneapolis, and I think that you will likely see either murder or manslaughter charges for this officer at a state level, which those state charges cannot be pardoned by the president, and you will see this officer be charged with that and vigorously prosecuted, and will be, you know, put in front of a jury of his peers, and we'll see at that time what the judgment is. But I am happy that he will face, it looks like, justice on the state level at least.
But how much evidence will disappear and be manipulated between now and then, and how much opinion?
I mean, and separate from that, even getting access to the right now to the evidence,
Cornish
right?
Report.
Well, there are how many videos though of this incident? I mean, if there, I would say that there's a lot more evidence now of what took place than what you would typically see in a criminal case 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, right? There's multiple videos.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. But the public comments by elected officials in the Trump administration have really tainted the perception, the investigative process, the way you typically gather evidence. You know, the whole point is to try to tilt public opinion in a way that makes it difficult for him to even get a fair trial, for them to even be able to find a jury, because the public has already been swayed by public officials that nothing wrong happened here. So I just feel like that while there will be a state trial, certainly if you're the person conducting that trial, the attorney general, you're very frustrated right now that you can't have access to the type of things you would normally have access to.
No, I just wish there were more politicians standing up and calling for, I mean, in Congress, you know, calling for the federal investigation of this that is, you know, holds ICE accountable. I mean, ICE needs to be held accountable, and they seem to be immune from it. And they're just getting stronger and growing, and they're well-funded.
We are out of time. I want to thank everyone who was with us this morning and all of you for listening. Thank you for your letters. And thanks, of course, to our wonderful panel. J.P. Miller will be watching the Empire Report throughout the day for updates regarding the state of the state and the response. The fun part is right at the end when you get 800 emails about the statements from the different groups.
That's not that fun.
Yeah, yeah, and then figuring out. Oh, you great!
Here we go. You said the fun part of the state of the state. I'm waiting with bated breath.
Yes. Well, you keep going and have as much fun as humanly possible. Karen Riedel, tell us where you'll be again tonight in Woodstock.
I will be at the Woodstock Library at 6:30 to hear from fabulous panelists about the current national security strategy to better understand the situation in Venezuela, the upcoming situation in Iran. And I do want to emphasize it's open to the public. Anybody can come, bring your friends, bring your family members. And the beauty of our events is that they're truly interactive.
Wonderful. And that at the Woodstock Library tonight. And Mike Spain, you got anything fun to tell us about?
No, I'm just looking forward to the next roundtable panel tomorrow.
Are you back tomorrow?
No.
Oh, okay.
I want to listen.
Oh, fantastic. Wow. And last but certainly not least, Terry Gibson.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being here today. It means so much to all of us. And you're great. You're wonderful. It's fantastic to have you in the studio. And we can't wait till we get to see you again.
Well, thanks so much. I'm happy to be here and hope to come back again soon. And
well, and you'll be on the show.
I'll be on the show, yeah. And if you're ever in the Boston area, look me up. I'll be there.
All right. I'll have to think about that soon.
I'm heading back today.
Yeah, we should do. Yeah.
Go over the Berkshire.
Yeah. On the road.
We'll head on
over. Thank you all. You're wonderful. I appreciate it. We're going to continue the roundtable program with our third hour coming up after this short break next on WAMC.